We're learning Shmuel Beis. We're up to the 11th parak. We're in the middle of the 11th chapter. We are going to start Pasuk Ches, which can be found on page 264. This is a parak in which I mentioned last week is PG-13 or maybe rated R, because it discusses, well, that was last week. We discussed a relationship between David and Bathsheba. And while Bathsheba was anxiously awaiting her husband, who was fighting a war, David stayed in Yerushalayim. This is what we were discussing last week. He climbed on top of a roof, and he saw this beautiful woman who was Bathsheba, and she was bathing. We learned that it's possible what she was actually doing was she was immersing herself in a mikvah, in a ritual bath, which means that she was tahar. She was certainly pure, but there was a major issue. She was married. And we discussed last week that one of the things that was done, because David was extremely sensitive to the potential aguna problems, that if, in the event that a man is just unknown, if he's alive or possibly he died at battle, then his wife will remain in this status of limbo for the rest of her life, not knowing if she's in fact an Eishes Ish, if she's still married, meaning her husband is still alive somewhere, maybe he died. In the event that husband had died in battle, then of course she's allowed to remarry. So what David did with his great sensitivity was he required every single soldier to write a divorce document, a get, to his wife. So every single person, right? We talk about how high the divorce rate is now. Unfortunately, the divorce rate then was 100%. But it was only written al tanai. It was on a condition, in the event that I don't come back after a certain amount of time, then it's understood that you can, this divorce document retroactively worked, and therefore we were just divorced, and therefore you can remarry. And of course, if I come back to from the war, then we're, the divorce document will be torn in half. It was rendered worthless. And therefore, Uriah Hachiti, who was in the battlefield, had already written this divorce document to his wife. And therefore, all you have to do is one small little detail. Make sure he dies. Right. And once he dies, then what will end up happening is he'll be able to, David will have been able to have married her, or in the event that if not having married her, but having taken her and her having conceived, then that child would not be a mamzer, because that would be the status of this child. And it was pointed out something which was overlooked last week, which is very worthwhile starting off, looking at the English on page 265, which is underlined on the left column. So, the first paragraph talks about how it was Ruach HaKodesh, and this relationship was really already predestined all the way from, as the Talmud says, Sheshes Mebrachos, from the very beginning of the creation of the world. We look at the second paragraph. It tells us a very important idea. Bathsheba had a child who died soon after birth. So this child that she had conceived in this questionable relationship was not going to be the next king of Israel. It was not going to be Shlomo. Because this child who had, she had conceived will die early, soon after birth. Let's just read the rest of this paragraph. And then she gave birth to Solomon, meaning that about 2 years elapsed from the time David had met her until Solomon was born. Since Shlomo became king at the age of 12, which we'll see in a long time from now, so he was 12 years old, and David died at the age of 70, so he was 58 years old when Shlomo was born. David was 58 years old. He was in the late 50s when he had his son Shlomo, and therefore right now he's approximately 56 years old when he encountered Bathsheba. So, but the point of all this is we're not discussing Shlomo HaMelech at all, his status of whether or not is he a mamzer, is he not a mamzer, because it was referring to a different child that tragically died soon after birth. That's something which we're going to see. Not yet. He will die.
He was with Bathsheba before he died.
Right. While Uri Achiti was loyally fighting on the battlefield, David was... Yeah. Yeah.
Was he Jewish? Because then he died.
Excellent question. So if we look at the Radak cites two possibilities to that question. The Radak, which was already in Pasuk Gimel, which we saw, but nonetheless worthwhile addressing. If you look on the very first wide line on page 264, Uyachiti Esher Ki Ger Hoya. You see that? It's possible that he was a convert, right? So, which means he really was from Chais, but he converted, so he's a Jew by choice. Oh, Yisrael Hoya, really he was born Jewish. So why does he get this strange last name of Uriachiti? Because Uriachiti lifi shigarim b'necheis. That's where he lived. Okay. So therefore, because of this, that's his title. But regardless, he was certainly someone who was Jewish. Whether he was born Jewish or converted to Judaism, he certainly is 100% a Jew. Bathsheba's husband at the time, his name is Uriah Hachiti. Chiti is Ches, which seems to imply that he may not have been Jewish. Maybe he came from such and such a location, and therefore one of the commentators, the Radak, says that either that's where he just lived, but he was really Jewish, but they just named that's where he was from, or possibly that he converted.
Do we know that Bathsheba was Jewish?
Bathsheba, we haven't really been introduced to until this point.
So we don't know her background or anything. Just a beautiful young
lady. Yeah. I mean, the Talmud we touched upon last week, I mean, Bathsheba is certainly a Hebrew name, right? It means the daughter seven. And one of the commentators we touched upon last week said that it means that in those days people aged differently, and when she was born, her parents were seven. That's why she's called Bathsheba.
She could be the seventh daughter.
The Talmud doesn't bring that as a possibility, but it certainly is open to interpretation. But regardless, it's a Hebrew name, so it would stand to reason that she was probably a Hebrew, a Jew. Okay, so with that little introduction, let's continue in Pasuk Ches. So now we have this beautiful woman, this beautiful pregnant woman, goes to David and says, I have some news to tell you, I'm pregnant. And so obviously David is in a major situation. Uriachiti's alive right now. And you can imagine the Chilul Hashem, this great man, David HaMelech, that he would be known to have committed such a sin. Lahavdil. Lahavdil.
Right, Lahavdil.
Okay, but we're gonna touch upon later on David's sin, and sin is really in quotations because it's certainly a lot to discuss whether he did anything truly wrong. We're gonna see in the following chapter that he does say Chatasi, I made a mistake. I fell short of the mark. But it certainly is tremendous interpretation exactly what happened. Okay. So let's begin with Pasuk Ches. The very bottom, page 264. Vayomer David Uriah. So David had already told people to get Uriachiti off the battlefield and to be summoned to stand before the king. So David speaks to Uriah and he says, Rei Leveischa, I want you to go down to your house, or Chatz Raglecha, wash your filthy feet, take a nice bath. Which meant go back home and relax and go back to your wife. Vayetzi Uriah mibeis haMelech, and Uriah Achiti went from the house of the king. Vayetzi achar maseis haMelech, and as it's translated over here, a royal feast was sent after him. So why was David trying to be so nice to this guy Uriah Achiti? After all, maybe he wants him dead. So why is he saying go back to your house and enjoy a nice meal and take a nice shower? So we touched upon this already, but it's worthwhile seeing the Rashi in Pasuk Vav. The last Rashi on page 264 says, "Shoyim eschaven sheyishkav im ishto, veisaver shimimenu him uberes." So he was hoping that Uriachiti would go back home, and he would be intimate with his wife, and of course his wife would be pregnant, and therefore what would Uriachiti think? Oh, Baruch Hashem, I have a son. And we jokingly said, you know, maybe he won't look so much like the father, but nonetheless, this is a way to cover David. David made this mistake, if you will, and now Uriachiti will be able to undo this mistake by just simply going home, and no one will know. It'll be this little secret between David and Bathsheba, and Uriachiti will never know, and they'll be able to just continue living a nice, happy, and a healthy relationship. No problem. That would be a great thing to do. Pasuk Tes continues and tells us that Uriachiti did not follow David's advice. V'yishkach, v'yishkab, Uri Pesach Beis HaMelech. Uri just lie down in the front of the house of the king, the palace. It's Kol Avdei Adonav, together with all of the servants of David. V'yorin Obesa, and he did not go to his house. He didn't go back home. He decided to stay put. V'yagidu David Leimor. And it was told to David that Lo Yored Uri El Beso. Can you imagine? Uriachiti had the opportunity to go back home to relax. He did his duty on the battlefield, and the king himself gives him this right to go back home. He decides not to. So David was told, you know, Lo Yored Uri El Beso. He did not go back home. V'yomer David El Uri. So David was getting obviously very worried about this. And therefore he turned to Uri and said, "Hello, Mederech Ataba, Madua lo yuranta el beisecha." I don't understand. You're coming from a very long trip. You were just on the battlefield. You're dirty, you're tired, you're filthy, you're hungry probably. Why don't you go home? Lam madua lo yuranta el beisecha. Go back to your house. And again, obviously he had his own intentions as to why he was telling him to do so. But regardless, he wasn't understanding. Why aren't you going back home? So, Pasuk Yud Aleph, V'yomer Uriel David. Uriel says, what are you talking about? Ha'aron v'Yisrael v'Yehuda yoshim basukos. You have all these things and people sitting in a sukkah, in a booth, namely the Aron, which was, as we learned in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph, that sometimes the ark was brought onto the battlefield to hopefully get the Jewish people to stare at it and then remember that it's not their strength, but rather it's Hashem. The Aron, the Jewish people, Yehuda, everyone is sitting in booths. They're in these little huts, these little tents. V'Adoni Yoav V'Avde Adoni Al Pnei Asad. And my master Yoav and my master's servants, they're on the battlefield right now. Chonim, that's where they're encamped. Aniya, Avo, Basi. I should go back to my house. Lecho, Vlishtos, to eat and to drink. Vlishkav, Imishti, and to be with my wife. Chayech, Vachain Dashach, I swear to you by your life and the life of your soul. Im Eses, Adabar Hazef, I will do such a thing. There's no way I am going to do it. I think it's completely ridiculous for me to do this and to live a comfortable life at the same time in which my brothers are dying in the battlefield. I can't do it. It's wrong for me to do. I feel uncomfortable. So I appreciate the offer, but I really don't think it's something I'm interested in doing.
The king, like, that's the thing.
Correct. Correct. So since you brought that up, looking at the English on the bottom, which I was going to touch upon later on, but since it was asked, we are going to see that David is going to try more than once to get him to go home, and he's going to refuse. Ultimately, what will happen, as we'll see in the sentences, is that David says, okay, you don't want to go back home? Go back into the battlefield. And when he goes back in the battlefield, they're going to put him right in the very front lines in a very vulnerable and compromising situation, and that the enemies will certainly kill him. In fact, we're going to see in the sentences, he's going to say, I want you to take Uri Achiti, and for him to go up with other people. He's not going to walk up by himself. And then while he's up there, and all the enemies are about to charge, everyone else around him will fall back. So who's left? But me, just one guy. Consider yourself dead. So that's one question is, how could David have done such a thing? And the answer is, Mord b'malchus. That Uri Achiti rebelled against the king. Why did he rebel against the king? Go ahead. So you said one of the answers.
Because he told him to do something, then he had to do it. And I think he also said that here he was anxious to go back and to fight and not to enjoy himself, and the king was like enjoying himself.
Right, so
not fighting.
He was almost insulting the king. It wasn't just, I'm not listening to what you have to say, but it's, what are you doing here? Right? You have the audacity to think that everything is all fine. What type of king are you? So, that certainly is another acceptable interpretation. Those are the ways that Tosfos explains why Uri Achiti was Mord b'Malchus, how he rebelled against the king. And according to Rashi, and I may or may not have underlined it in Pasuk Yud Aleph, we find that when he was speaking back to David, he said, you know, Aaron, the Jewish people, they're in these temporary booths. Va'adoni Yoav. And my master Yoav, who was in charge of the army, he's over there fighting this war. So according to the opinion of Rashi felt the idea being Mord b'Malchus is that he called Yoav my master in front of
king.
How could you call someone else your master in front of your king who is supposed to be your only master? And therefore, for that reason, according to Rashi, by that choice of words, Adoni Yoav, he was like undermining David, which is probably the same idea. What you're saying is Yoav is really the master because he's fighting. And look at you, you're doing nothing. You're sitting here doing nothing. So that was another form of being more of a malchus. Now, when it comes to rebelling against a king, you have a couple of options. A king can just take those people who are rebellious and have them killed. Finished. And there's nothing you can do about it. That's it. So therefore, when David decides, instead of killing him in the palace, sentencing him to death for speaking the way he did, decides to put him on the battlefield. Which is the same way. He's going to die either way. The same outcome will occur, except one significant difference. And what's that difference? Was Bathsheba married at the time of the conception? So if, in fact, he's killed, rightfully so, in the palace for rebelling, I say, take him over there and off with his head. So what ends up happening? He died not at war. So therefore, that divorce document was specifically written that it will retroactively work only in the event that I would die in war. So I didn't die at war. I was already home. I was already safe in our little town. And then I died. And therefore, obviously, now the second his head is chopped off, now she can, of course, marry whoever she wishes. But the problem is the mistake that was made doesn't work retroactively. So therefore, at the time that David was with Bathsheba, she was a married woman. However, if in fact he would die on the battlefield, which is what happens, then the get kicks in, and that divorce document says that retroactively she was never married from the time it was written, which was before the incident of David and Bathsheba.
I understand. He's dead anyhow. The get no longer plays any role. What's the difference? I mean, if you... It doesn't make sense to me. He's gone, so... She's a free woman. I mean, you're not
going to
somebody's
head. Correct.
Yeah, but that's not the point. What role does the get play?
Because the get was the
time
to die in war.
But when did he? But he's dead. What's the difference?
No, Larry. Before
he was
married.
You're talking about the child.
Yeah. We're talking about the child.
Oh, okay.
And the act, the sinful act of committing adultery retroactively does not become an act of sin.
Not that he's a free man.
Right. Either way, Bathsheba can marry whoever she wants as soon as Uriah dies, because that's one of the two ways you can remarry.
But what happened to the Kohen? With the wife of the Kohen, they gave a get that money. Could she remarry her husband? Was it considered like a get?
But that's why it's a Tanai. It's a condition. So if in fact I come back, we were never divorced. It's not that we're divorced and now let's get remarried. It's not like all of a sudden there was all the videographers are excited because now there's a second wedding, you know, and okay, we have all the banquet halls get filled up. They were never divorced retroactively. You're right. If you would give that get, it becomes a problem. You're allowed to remarry your... There's also an issue of you're not allowed to remarry the same woman that you divorced. That's only if she married someone else in between.
For a Kohen
is a problem, right?
So
a Kohen is not allowed to marry Grusha.
That's what I have to do.
Right. So it was nothing. The divorce document is just torn up and it's put in the shredder. It's worthless.
Yeah, but the Kohen gives her a divorce on Sinai,
mm-hmm.
and he dies. Then she was retroactively divorced, right? And she's considered a divorced woman.
Right.
But if he had died regularly in battle, she would be considered a widow, not
right.
a divorced.
Correct.
Woman. So
it's true.
It gives her an extra problem.
The get on one hand helps the aguna issue for the co the
right.
woman who's
but if they know that he died and they found the body, then she is in the status of a divorced lady rather than just the widow of the Kohen.
And the issue would be, can she remarry a Kohen,
right.
another Kohen
right.
afterwards, right? So the fact that if it was a get retroactively, then right, you're right. That's why it's very questionable, this halachic status, and that's what Vivian was touching upon. If the person died, and we know, is this get really in a situation where we're not sure?
Do they do that today? Do they get on tonight?
Probably someone last week mentioned something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it, but we today.
So, it's... But you're right, there could be... The way that we're interpreting this Rashi, which we saw last week... When it comes to a Kohen, it could become an issue as far as them remarrying, because a Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorced woman, but a Kohen is allowed to marry an almana, a widow. Okay, that's the significant difference in halacha.
There's something here in English, it says, he would have been forbidden to marry her even after her husband's death. And there's a thing, Sota
27a. Right. Because the Talmud discusses... that in the situation where she committed adultery, that in which there was adult, they obviously both did, that she is not only forbidden to the husband, but also to the man as well, that she committed adultery with. Because obviously that would be, we would be promoting this type of activity to continue. But if people are aware that if you would do such a thing, that halakhically you're no longer permissible. Obviously they weren't permissible then either, but if they would get divorced or something else happened, they can no longer. So therefore that's a way to remove these possible scenarios from happening. You're right. So that would have been another issue for David and Bathsheba to remain or to get married, as we'll see at the end of this chapter. So anyway, this is the idea of him being Mored B'Malchus, of rebelling against the king. There's one other interpretation, which I'll just share with you, and then we'll plow through a little bit here, is that, according to some, Oryachiti was no fool. He knew exactly what was going on. I mean, come on. Everyone else is fighting a war. For some reason, you're letting me leave the battlefield, and you're pushing me and persuading me to go back to my wife. There's something strange over here. And therefore, some explain... The Oryachiti knew that David had been with his wife, or with Bathsheba, and that she was probably pregnant. And therefore he said, you know what? I'm not going back. I'm not going to listen to you. Because I know what happened, and I want you to be humiliated when all this unfolds. I don't want to have to cover up for my wife for what she did. Why would I want to do that? And why should I cover up for you? And therefore the fact that he did that, he wanted to create this Chil Hashem and to publicize what happened and to make this a huge scandal when David was trying to minimize it and keep it as quiet as possible. So those are the different explanations of what Oryachiti did, which was rebelling against the king. All right. And again, the English on the bottom over here basically discusses the ideas that we already touched upon. So let's move on then. Pasuk Yud-Beis. Pasuk Yud-Beis tells us, Vayomer David el Uriah, She bazet gam hayom umachar ashalchacha. So you know what? Why don't you stay over here and stay with me, and then tomorrow I'll send you off. So why did David want him to hang out with him? Vayeshev Uriah b'Yerushalayim. So Uriah Chiti stayed in Yerushalayim. You know, the king told him to stay there. Okay, I have no problem with that. I'll just stay by the palace. B'yomahu u'mincharas. He stayed on that day and the next day. Pasuk Gimel. V'yikru lo David v'yochel afanam v'yeshakrehu. So what was David's intention? Again, to get him a little drunk. Give him some nice food. And got him drinking, and he became intoxicated. So once his senses were a little bit dull and numbed, he was hoping this may be a better opportunity for me to be able to push him out of the palace and to go back home. Vayetzi bo erev lishkav v'mishkavo im avde adonav v'el beisolo yarab. So David was hoping he would go back home and he would be drunk and who knows, he wouldn't even know what was going on. Unfortunately, he did not He did not go to his house, but he decided to sleep im avdei adonav. He stayed where he was. Maybe he was so drunk he couldn't, you know, make it his way home. You know, didn't want to get arrested for drunk driving. He decided to stay where he was and go back home. So now we have a huge problem. We have David HaMelech that realizes there is nothing that I can do to possibly convince this guy to go back home. All right, and if you look in the English, this is basically what the Abarbanel says on page 267. David told Uriah to remain for one more day. He would wine and dine him in the royal residence, and then perhaps Uriah's resolve would weaken, and he would go home to Bathsheba. But his plan failed as well. Uriah remained in Jerusalem. He did not go home, which is basically what pretty explicit in the sentences. Pasuk Yudal. Vayiva boker, and it was in the morning. So what? This guy is not going home. There's nothing I can do. What other tricks do I have up my sleeve? So in the morning, Vayichtav David Sefer El Yoav. So David writes up this document, and he gives it, sends it forth to Yoav. And who should he have to send this? This is before UPS. V'yishlach biyad Uriah. So he sent it into the hands of Uriah. Uriah Chiti was just waiting with much anticipation to go back into the battlefield. So he says, okay, that's what you want? I'll bring you back to the battlefield. Do me a favor, that while you are going there anyway, I have a little letter that I want Yoav to read. Could you please give it to him? V'yichtov ba'sefer lemor, and he wrote in this book, or in this document, Havu el Uriah el mul p'nei ha'melchama ha'chazaka, that you should take this man Uriah and you should put him in front of the part of the war which is very powerful, our enemies who are very strong. V'shavtem yacharav v'nika v'meis. V'shavtem yacharav, as we said, that the people that will be with him side by side in their lines, they will drop back, and there will be Uriah Chiti all by himself, and v'meis. He'll die. What other possibility is there? He's going to be by himself, and he's going to be a charge of enemies are coming after him. Certainly, he will die. So, one of the great things we see from Uriah Chiti is that he obviously didn't read this letter, right? I'd be kind of curious to want to read what this letter said. It was probably sealed, right? I'm sure it was sealed, but we certainly it's derived actually halachically from this pasuk. The Rabbeinu Gershom, who's famous for certain decrees, one of the most famous decrees is to aser polygamy and things of that nature. You're not allowed to read someone else's mail, and that's what we see from this story. And getting into ethics, business ethics, if you can read your employees' emails and things of that nature, is all these halachic ramifications and issues, but we can find this as an interesting source that shows that even though you know the letter that you're holding 100% is about you, and he's holding it up against the sunlight, he can read right through it, he didn't read it. Obviously, if he read it, probably he would turn around.
So he seems like an ethical person. He didn't want to enjoy himself while the people were fighting. He didn't read the mail. You know, he doesn't seem like such a terrible person.
Who said it was terrible?
No, but I think the same thing. It's like David wanted Bathsheba,
right,
and so he didn't listen, so they kind of made him bad, but really he was doing all these very moral things, this bad.
That's how I was thinking.
And it's David who was like, you know, trying to find a way to get him gone.
You're right. It's
I think you need to talk about 14 to 17 Rabbi Nimesh. The commentary name is 14.
Please, go ahead.
No, I mean, but, you know, this has always been a great puzzle and a great source of disillusionment, I guess, to many of us, this whole story.
Right.
And, of course, one of the first things you read is, I think it's the Talmud that says, whoever says that it doesn't commit a sin, is sin is a great error.
Right.
And a lot of these things are trying to find an answer for. If you truly believe that Hashem is in charge of everything, then this whole scenario was worked out, and the actors are falling into place. And this seems to say the same thing. It says that it may be that David respected Uriah and wanted him to die as a hero and not as a disgraced rebel. Or David may have put Uriah's faith in the hands of God, since warriors do not necessarily die even when they are exposed to great danger. So, I mean, you know, it depends upon where you're standing on that spectrum how you want to look at this whole thing. It's a very troubling part of our
world. He still didn't show respect for his other. He still did. Big joke, and that was
right.
A big thing.
Right. So he wasn't so perfect after all. I mean, talking about Uriah Hittite, right? The way he spoke?
That's right. He wasn't so perfect. Right. He showed disrespect to the king.
Right. Yeah.
But I put him in a position also that he showed disrespect.
I understand.
Right.
He was
free will, and doing what he felt was morally correct. Wanting to do what he felt.
On the other hand, when a king tells you something, even if you don't understand it, you have to do it. Even if it makes no sense. And that's the same thing if we can make a quantum leap to the King of Kings. There are mitzvos that we have, which are chukim, we don't understand, which make no sense. We still have to do it. We can't question. We can question to try to understand what we're doing a little bit better, but we can't question it to the point and say, it's wrong. That's what he did.
Right.
That's what he did.
But why did the child that came from their first union have to die? I mean, that seems to be indicating something was wrong.
I mean, that's possible that there's that shows that even
because
if he did
it. Shlomo, you can say, obviously it was meant to be because he was the king and Mashiach comes from David and everything and his descendants, but the first child died. So.
I mean, childbirth. Then was also much more dangerous.
Union blessed by God, or if it was meant
right.
To be, it was okay.
Right. No, it's a good point as well that it shows that there is something not 100% in this relationship either. You're going to say something?
Yeah. First of all, he couldn't. I mean, Shlomo HaMelech couldn't have come from this union. It wasn't really kosher. It was really. No, he said it wasn't. They said specifically that it was not. Okay,
but maybe people would have thought it was that.
The only thing that I found very wonderful about this is that it shows David as a human being, as a man.
No, but then the Torah said that
he should
have
seen him. He made a mistake. So you find excuses. That's the wonderful of the Jewish religion.
We're not
allowed
to
say excuses.
We're not allowed to
say excuses for everything.
So let me conclude.
Basically,
yes.
It wasn't
right. Let me conclude with what. It's certainly up to tremendous discussion exactly what it is, what happened, and I'm going to share with you what the Gemara says about this whole chapter. Very interesting sentence over here, and we can build upon this possibly when we discuss this further next week. The Talmud says that David obviously prayed continuously, And one of the things that he said to Hashem was, "V'nekisi mepesha rav shel yichtav sarchuni." He says that I did tshuva, I did something on some level which was a mistake, which we'll touch upon more next week exactly what that was. But apparently he acknowledges that he makes a mistake, and he says, "Please, shel yichtav sarchuni." Please do not allow this to be written, this error, in your text. In other words, David prayed to God, please take this entire chapter out of Torah Shebichtav. It shouldn't be written here. Because of, listen to our conversations. I mean, David did tshuva already. You know, he changed. So David's saying, you know, I made a mistake. It was a personal mistake. I did whatever I had to do to make right on that mistake. Why does everyone have to continue for all future generations to have to discuss this embarrassment? So, the Talmud says something very strange. The Talmud says, "Eifshar." It's impossible for this chapter to be removed. He says, "My yud shenetalti misarai." Sarai, her name was changed to Sarah. So one letter was removed, the letter Yud, which is the third letter in Sarai. Omid b'tzavach kamashonim. That letter, so to speak, cried out for many years, having been removed. Ad sheba Yehoshua, until Yehoshua came, and I added the letter Yud to his name, as the pasuk says in Parsha Shlach, Vikra Moshe Lehoshea binun Yehoshua. So his name was changed from Hoshea to Yehoshua. So basic, and then the Talmud concludes and says, so kol parsha kula alachas kam v'kam. You want me to remove an entire chapter? I can't do that. Even one letter is a problem. So how do you expect me to lose this entire chapter? So the idea of how some people interpret what this Talmud, what the Gemara is saying, is David says this is humiliation, this is embarrassment. You know, and it should be my problem. And Hashem is saying, but you have to understand, this chapter is not about your mistake. It's about giving chizuk for all future generations that, first of all, a king can make mistakes, can acknowledge that they've made mistakes, and that a person has the opportunity to improve, a person has the opportunity to do tshuva. And therefore, this whole chapter discusses not the focus of his mistake, but it's the idea that we should also learn from our mistakes. We can own up to our mistakes. We can improve, and we can do tshuva. And if King David, who you can imagine, we know when it comes to people in high political positions, they're constantly trying to cover themselves up so to not admit that they made a mistake. David is willing, as we'll discuss next chapter, Chatasi, I am not perfect. That gives us tremendous strength to realize that we are also not perfect, and it's okay not to be perfect. That the Torah should not only show supermen, superwomen. Everyone is 100% perfect. We have to be able to dig and understand their mistake. We can't just say they sinned and they made a mistake and compare them to other politicians that we've experienced, other presidents of the United States. They're not on the same madriga. So when the Talmud says, anyone who says that they sinned is a mistake, it means you can't put this sin on the same level as our base understanding of what the sin is. You have to dig and understand what exactly he really did wrong, which we'll hopefully get a little bit more of understanding as we continue. But what David was requesting, Hashem says, I will never remove this chapter, because this is a chapter of doing tshuva that we can all improve. Stop here.